content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are in the July 1st / July 8th issue of The Week magazine. This will be our first reading of two, the main stories and how they were covered. Senate Republicans block gun control bills. What happened? The U.S. Senate rejected four competing gun control measures this week as lawmakers struggled to agree on an appropriate legislative response to the killing of 49 people by an ISIS-inspired gunman in Orlando. Senator Dianne Feinstein proposed empowering the Attorney General to stop those on the FBI's terror watch list from buying a weapon, while Senator John Cornyn suggested delaying such sales for up to 72 hours, during which the authorities would have to convince a judge if they wanted to block the purchase. To strengthen background checks, Democrats proposed closing the loopholes for gun show sales and private transactions, while the Republicans' alternative focused on improving the existing system. Both Republican-sponsored bills secured majority support but fell short of the filibuster-proof 60-vote margin. The debates over the legislation took place in a highly charged partisan atmosphere, with 40 House Democrats staging a sit-in on the House floor. How many more fathers need to shed tears of grief before we do something, said Representative John Lewis. Earlier, Senator Chris Murphy conducted a 15-hour filibuster on gun control, charging that the National Rifle Association has a vice-like grip on Congress. GOP legislators said they were considering a compromise bill introduced by Senator Susan Collins, under which about 2,800 U.S. citizens on two of the most serious FBI watch lists, those forbidden from flying and those who receive extra airport security screening, would be banned from purchasing weapons. What the editorial said: Democrats have finally figured out how to strip Americans of their Second Amendment rights, said NationalReview.com. Deny them their Fifth Amendment rights, too. Those on the FBI's terrorist watch list haven't been charged with an offense. They've simply been identified as a potential risk by anonymous government officials, often in error. That's not sufficient grounds to deny citizens due process. Instead of eroding our rights, we should be using aggressive tactics to root out Islamic terrorists in our country. Republicans and the NRA are now officially complicit in terrorism, said the New York Times. As terrorist recruiters said in a 2011 video, America is absolutely awash in easily obtainable firearms. What are you waiting for? Now that lone wolf terrorists in San Bernardino and Orlando have acted on this advice, our lax restrictions have become a full-blown national security hazard. The Supreme Court has acknowledged that reasonable gun control laws are fully consistent with the Second Amendment rights. Only this week, the justices refused to take up challenges to state laws banning assault weapons and large-capacity magazines. Yet still, Congress does nothing. Its inaction is killing us. What the columnist said: Let me explain why millions of Americans own an AR-15 assault weapon, said John Stokes in Vox.com. Having been extensively tested and improved by the military, these rifles are more reliable than most weapons, with fewer jams and better accuracy, and they can easily be customized for an infinite variety of sporting, hunting, and use-of-force scenarios. As the best rifle on the market, AR-15s are massively popular with shooters of all stripes, including hunters, competitive marksmen, people who want to protect their homes, and the police. Most AR-15 owners are neither terrorists nor delusional survivalists. The fact remains that assault weapons are terrorists' new weapons of choice, said E.J. Dionne in the Washington Post. That's because they're designed not for deer hunting or varmint killing, but for mass slaughter. The Supreme Court has expressly authorized reasonable restrictions on gun rights, which is why it's illegal to buy machine guns and rocket-propelled grenade launchers. Assault weapons should be in that same category. How can conservatives insist we must do everything possible to fight terrorism and yet block all attempts to stop terrorists from buying weapons of war? I just wish the liberals were more honest about their goals, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. They have to know that an assault weapon ban won't significantly reduce gun violence, and that terrorists will simply turn to semi-automatic handguns or other weapons. Their real hope is that a more liberal Supreme Court will reverse the 2008 Heller decision affirming an individual's right to bear arms so they can ban guns on a mass scale. Everyone knows this is the case, but no one admits it. Enough. An open debate on the Second Amendment would actually be a refreshing change. And a second main story. Trump overhauls his floundering campaign. What happened? Donald Trump attempted to reset his Republican presidential campaign this week following a poll collapse and the release of dismal fundraising numbers by firing his combative campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski, and launching a fierce attack on Democratic rival Hillary Clinton. Trump's children reportedly orchestrated the removal of Lewandowski, who in March was charged with misdemeanor battery for manhandling a female reporter. The charge was later dropped. Lewandowski had advocated a "let Trump be Trump" strategy, but several Trump aides, including veteran GOP strategist Paul Manafort, argued that the campaign's failure to organize and fundraise, combined with the candidate's lack of discipline, had enabled Clinton to open a six-point lead. After security escorted Lewandowski out of Trump Tower, new federal filings revealed that Trump's campaign had less than $1.3 million in the bank heading into June, disastrously short of Clinton's $42 million total. In an attempt to rally panicked Republicans, Trump gave a blistering speech on Clinton's character, accusing her of being a world-class liar who used her position as Secretary of State to solicit donations for the Clinton Foundation. She ran the department like her own personal hedge fund, Trump said. In a speech on the economy a day earlier, Clinton said the businessman had run many of his ventures into the ground, including Trump University and his three Atlantic City casinos, and warned that his policies would throw us back into recession. What the columnist said. Trump is not running a bad campaign, said Chris Saliza in Washington Post. He's barely running any sort of campaign at all. He raised $3.1 million in May, less than a typical Senate or House candidate, has spent zero on TV ads in swing states, and has only 69 staffers compared with Clinton's 683. Trump's strategy so far revolved around calling in to TV show news shows and sending angry tweets. That's not a campaign. It's a vanity effort designed to pump up the Trump brand. Perhaps this is a turning point in the Trump campaign, said The Economist in an editorial. With Lewandowski gone, desperate Republicans now hope that consultants and tasseled loafers will descend and turn the businessman into a disciplined, focus group candidate. Trump is already taking baby steps in the right direction, said Ben Dominic in TheFederalist.com. He's brought in two experienced GOP advisors to refocus his campaign, and more hires are expected. Now it's time for Trump to drop Lewandowski's divisive primary tactics and put his trust in Team Manafort. A campaign shakeup won't save Trump, because he still thinks he can win through the luminescent force of his personality, said Paul Waldman in the Washington Post. Who needs fundraisers, a field operation, or voter research? If I just do my thing, Trump thinks, it'll all work out great. Even if Manafort ascends to campaign manager, it won't matter. No aide or lackey is going to tell Trump what to do, and that's Trump's biggest problem. Our controversy of the week, Orlando. Why didn't the FBI stop Mateen? It's unfair to expect that U.S. law enforcement can track and stop every would-be terrorist, said Michael Hirsch in Politico.com. But as we learn more about Omar Mateen, the ISIS follower who slaughtered 49 clubgoers and wounded 53 more in Orlando last weekend, the FBI's failure to prevent the massacre is starting to look like a huge and tragic mistake. Federal agents, we now know, had interviewed Mateen no fewer than three times since 2013, after informants tipped them off that he was boasting of links to terrorist groups, making threats against his colleagues, and watching online videos by Anwar al-Awlaki, the U.S.-born al-Qaeda recruiter. Mateen was threatening to shoot classmates for laughing at his Muslim customs as far back as 2007, said Jim Garrity in NationalReview.com. And only weeks ago, a Florida gun shop alerted the FBI that a man matching Mateen's description was trying to buy body armor and bulk ammunition. When asked if his agents could have done more to stop Mateen, FBI Director James Comey said last week, "I don't think so." But Comey should think again. The hard truth is that the worst terror attack on U.S. soil since 9/11 was perpetrated by a man whose background bristles with red flags. You can't blame the FBI for Orlando, said Garrett Graff in Politico.com. The Bureau was right to investigate Mateen, just as it investigated Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the Boston Marathon bomber, and Major Nadal Hassan, who killed 13 soldiers at Fort Hood. But in each case, agents found no evidence of an imminent attack and had no choice but to shift their attention to other possible threats. To keep Mateen under round-the-clock surveillance indefinitely would have been unconstitutional. The government needs probable cause to infringe on your liberties even for a short time. Besides, the FBI just doesn't have the resources to closely monitor every person who expresses admiration for Islamic extremist groups or makes vague threats. Sources say the FBI has approximately 1,000 potential domestic terrorists on its radar, but the manpower to physically follow and just watch about 50 at any given time. That needs to change, said former FBI counterterrorism official David Gomez in foreignpolicy.com. With ISIS encouraging would-be jihadists to self-radicalize here in the U.S., rather than make trips for training overseas, the FBI needs more power and flexibility to identify these killers before they strike. It's too late for the Orlando victims, but if Congress lowered the probable cause standard for ongoing surveillance, it might assist in preventing future acts of terrorism. That's not a road America can afford to go down, said Massimo Calabrese in Time.com. The FBI's job is to catch people who have already broken the law. If we now empower federal agents to start surveilling and detaining all citizens who they suspect may break the law in the future, we'd in effect create an unaccountable Soviet-style secret police force. Absolute security is neither attainable nor desirable, said Glenn Greenwald in WashingtonPost.com. After an atrocity like Orlando or the Boston Marathon bombing, our compassion and our anger lead us to think, isn't it worth any cost to prevent such massacre in the future? But it isn't. After 9/11, the demand for absolute security led the U.S. government to embrace torture and mass surveillance and launch two decade-long wars. It is obviously unfortunate that nobody was able to stop Mateen, but in any free country, there always will be a tiny minority that abuses that freedom for evil purposes. This is the trade-off we make for liberty. It was a good week for meeting the neighbors after Cornell University researchers calculated that it may take 1,500 years for extraterrestrial civilizations to detect our signals and contact us. Space is a big place, the researcher said, but that doesn't mean no one is out there. It was a good week for Cleveland. After LeBron James and the Cavaliers became the first team to overcome a 3-1 deficit to win the NBA championship, delivering a major sports title to the beleaguered city for the first time in 52 years. And it was a good week for do-it-yourself security. After a photo of Mark Zuckerberg sitting at his desk revealed that the Facebook CEO has small pieces of tape over his laptop's camera and microphone, a well-known trick to help keep hackers from surveilling you. But it was a bad week for consistency. After Senator Marco Rubio announced he was running for re-election after all, despite having insisted a month ago that he only said 10,000 times that he'd become a private citizen in January. I changed my mind, the Florida Republican explained. It was a bad week for autonomy after a Russian robot designed to learn from experiences escaped from its testing facility and ambled into a busy intersection. After it was returned, it escaped again. We might have to dismantle it, one of the creators said. And it was a bad week for costume drama. After firefighters in Alabama spent 30 minutes struggling to free a 15-year-old girl who became stuck inside a Barney costume when the big purple head slid down over her shoulders. I was really worried for a while that they wouldn't be able to get it off me, said Darby Risner. And while we're here, this is a boring but important short titled Illegal Searches Ruling. The Supreme Court this week ruled 5-3 that courts need not throw out evidence obtained by police during an illegal stop, prompting a blistering dissent by Justice Sonia Sotomayor. The ruling reinstates the conviction of Edward Joseph Streif Jr., who in 2006 was stopped by a Salt Lake City narcotics detective, though the officer lacked reasonable cause. The detective then discovered Streif was the subject of an outstanding warrant for a minor traffic offense and searched him, finding drugs. The justices in the majority said the discovery of the warrant justified the officer's subsequent search. But Sotomayor said such reasoning would allow police to stop anyone, guilty and innocent, on a whim or a hunch. Going to read a few items this week from the page titled The U.S. at a Glance and the World at a Glance. So we'll start with the U.S. at a Glance from Las Vegas. Trump assassination plot. A British man allegedly attempted to assassinate Donald Trump at a campaign rally in Las Vegas this week, approaching a police officer and trying to grab his gun so that he could shoot the presumptive presidential nominee. Michael Stephen Sanford, 20, was quickly detained by security. It later emerged that he had been living in the country illegally after overstaying his visa. Sanford allegedly told Secret Service agents he had been plotting to assassinate Trump for more than a year and had bought tickets to Trump's next rally in Phoenix in case he didn't get through with the Las Vegas attack. Sanford's parents said he is emotionally troubled and suffers from Asperger's syndrome, and that they had recently begged U.S. authorities to help them bring him home. He has been charged with committing a violent act in a restricted area and faces up to 10 years in prison. Arizona, California, and New Mexico. Scorching temps. A record-setting heat wave sent temperatures soaring above 120 degrees across parts of Arizona, California, and New Mexico this week, killing at least five people and fueling devastating wildfires. The searing temperatures marked the hottest start to summer for all three states, with thermometers climbing to a record 116 degrees at Phoenix Sky Harbor International Airport and to 122 degrees in Palm Springs, California. In nearby Needles, California, the temperature hit 100 degrees by 7 a.m. that day. The heat wave caused a surge in power demand as more than 30 million people under heat warnings or advisories cranked up their air conditioners. Several Arizona residents managed to fry eggs on the sidewalk. Another in Phoenix baked cookies inside her car. At least three hikers died during the heat wave, as well as one mountain biker. Spring City, Tennessee. New nuclear plant. Officials powered up America's first new nuclear plant in two decades this week, launching a process of nuclear fission at the Watts Bar 2 reactor near Spring City, Tennessee, that should eventually generate enough electricity to power 650,000 homes. The reactor, which sits along the Chickamauga Reservoir, should be able to provide 1,411 megawatts of carbon-free electricity to the Tennessee Valley Authority electricity grid within a matter of weeks. Initial construction began on Watts Bar 2 more than 43 years ago, but previous attempts to open the facility were hampered by fluctuating energy demands and protests over safety. Some environmentalists, however, have pushed hard for the opening of a new nuclear facility. "It's a big step forward for clean energy," said MIT atmospheric scientist Carrie Emanuel, who said nuclear power would be crucial in hitting climate targets. Washington, D.C. Weapons ban stands. The Supreme Court this week declined to hear a Second Amendment challenge to a Connecticut law that bans certain semi-automatic assault weapons, including the kind of rifle used in the June 12th mass shooting in Orlando. The law, enacted in 2013 after the shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, makes it a crime to sell or possess more than 100 types of rifles with at least one military-style feature, such as a telescoping stock, and outlaws high-capacity magazines holding 10 or more bullets. The law was upheld in October by the Second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. In its landmark 2008 Heller decision, the court ruled that individuals had the right to own guns for self-protection, but with reasonable restrictions. Since then, the justices have turned down challenges to several state laws regulating firearms. And these from the World at a Glance, Ottawa, Canada. Legalizing assisted suicide. After protracted debate, Canada has passed a controversial bill to allow terminally ill people a medically assisted death. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau supported the measure but argued for strict limits on who is eligible. Patients must be mentally competent and in an advanced state of irreversible decline. The law also applies only to Canadians and permanent residents. Legislators said they did not want to see Canada become a destination for suicide tourism, as Switzerland has. A group of senators tried in vain to broaden the bill to allow suicide for those who are in a state of constant suffering, but not close to death. But Trudeau's government opposed the change. Oaxaca, Mexico. Teachers' protest turns deadly. At least 8 people were killed in violent clashes between police and members of a militant teachers union in Mexico this week. Teachers in Oaxaca State oppose a 2013 federal law that introduced mandatory teacher testing and banned educators from selling their jobs or passing them on to their children. Authorities said members of the National Coordinator of Education Workers blocked roads, and when police came to clear the roadblocks, union members took 5 officers hostage. Violence broke out during the rescue effort, with police opening fire and protesters throwing Molotov cocktails and torching cars. Oaxacan teachers say they are given practically no resources and must build their own schools. Caracas, Venezuela. More food riots. Desperate Venezuelans are looting stores for food as widespread shortages and hyperinflation have sent prices soaring. Nearly 90% of families say they can't afford food, and dozens of riots have broken out across the country in the past 2 weeks. At least 5 people have been killed. As riots spread, tens of thousands of people waited in line at electoral offices to validate their signatures on a petition to recall leftist president Nicolas Maduro, whom the opposition blames for the shortages. The opposition delivered nearly 2 million signatures in May, but the National Electoral Council, controlled by Maduro loyalists, said many were fake or invalid and is requiring signatories to come in person to validate their identities. Rio de Janeiro, Olympic crime. Muggers are targeting international athletes who are arriving in crime-plagued Rio de Janeiro to prepare for the Summer Olympics. Australian Paralympic sailor Liesl Tesch, 47, said she was bicycling through a city park with her physiotherapist this week when 2 men with guns demanded money, then pushed them off their bikes, which they stole. Last month, 3 Spanish Olympic sailors were robbed at gunpoint while walking in the city. Brazilian Olympic authorities say athletes and spectators shouldn't worry because some 85,000 police and soldiers will be on the streets once the games begin in August. But most athletes arrive long before that. Maybe the organizing committee should mobilize their games time defense force early, said Kitty Chiller, Australia's Olympic team leader. Do it now. From Tehran, terrorist plot foiled. Iranian intelligence says it has stopped what would have been the largest ever terrorist attack on Tehran. Intelligence Minister Mohammad Alavi announced that 10 militants were arrested as they plotted to bomb dozens of buildings and religious sites during the current holy month of Ramadan. Authorities seized more than 220 pounds of explosives and stopped the delivery of another 2 tons of explosives to terrorists, Alavi said. Iranian officials didn't name the specific group behind the plot, but said those arrested were Wahhabis, adherents of a strain of extremist Sunni Islam based in Saudi Arabia. Shiite Iran and Sunni Saudi Arabia are battling in proxy conflicts across the region, including in Syria and Yemen. Al-Tanf, Syria. U.S. versus Russia. American and Russian warplanes came close to a hostile encounter over Syria last week. Russia claims its military is only in Syria to fight ISIS, but in reality it has been targeting any forces opposed to its ally, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Last week, Russian fighter bombers attacked a garrison of U.S.-backed Syrian rebels near the Jordanian border. U.S. fighter jets immediately responded, taking to the air to shadow the Russians and opening a previously agreed-upon pilot-to-pilot communications channel to the Russians to warn them off. But the Russians circled back for another bombing run when the U.S. planes went to refuel, hitting first responders who were aiding victims of the initial strike. Patna, India. Lightning kills scores. Indian farmers begged the government for relief this week after 93 people were struck and killed by lightning in mostly rural areas over 2 days. Monsoon season often brings electric storms, but the one this week was shockingly intense. It was as though there was a war happening in the sky, said Rakesh Kumar Singh, head of a farmers' collective in Bihar State. The government announced that it will give about $6,000 to each of the victims' families. More than 2,500 people were killed by lightning in India in 2014, the most recent figure available. We can't stop because of the weather, said Lal Babu Ushavaha, a Bihar farmer. We have to keep working in the fields. Moving on to the columns now, we'll take in a couple extra this week. First two from the U.S. What mass killers have in common. Orlando shooter Omar Mateen controlled and abused his first wife, frequently used racial and homophobic slurs, and for years threatened to kill people he didn't like. When he finally lived out his murderous fantasies, said Amanda Marcotte, Mateen said he was acting in behalf of ISIS. But the root cause of his violence was toxic masculinity. Toxic masculinity is a distorted, specific form of manhood geared toward dominance and control, which views women and gays as inferior, valorizes violence, and glamorizes guns. It's the main reason why we have so many damn shootings in the U.S. While toxic masculinity aspires to toughness, it's rooted in a fear of being soft, weak, emasculated. Almost all mass killers share this fear, whether they embrace the grievances of ISIS or right-wing hate groups, or simply seek vengeance against co-workers or women who scorn them. Sadly, we can't stop these frequent rampages because the far right does not want its ability to engage in gun violence infringed by effeminate liberals. That leaves only one possible response to mass shootings: more toxic masculinity, with heavily armed tough guys exchanging deadly fire in bars, elementary schools, malls, and churches. Is that the society we want? America's new state religion. California is in the grip of an incipient state religion, said Joel Kotkin. The religion is liberal secularism, and it's no less intolerant and dogmatic than the state religions of Saudi Arabia, Iran, or the former Soviet Union. California's legislature has introduced a bill that would forbid religious universities and schools from discriminating against students, faculty, or administrators based on sexual orientation or gender identity, making it illegal for a conservative Christian school, for example, to turn away students or teachers who do not share its stated religious beliefs. Another bill, the Orwellian-named California Climate Science Truth and Accountability Act of 2016, would enable the state to prosecute any individual or company that has challenged the orthodoxy on climate change. These proposed laws reflect a highly authoritarian and illiberal brand of progressivism that now insists there is only one correct and legal view on controversial issues, such as gender in bathrooms, racism, gay marriage, and climate change. A nation founded on free expression and respect for individual liberty is transitioning into a one-party state where, increasingly, only the most orthodox views can be tolerated. That's not the nation our founders had in mind. From Italy, triumph of the political outsiders. Italy is in the throes of another political revolution, said Massimo Gramellini, After years of right-wing rule under Silvio Berlusconi and his allies, Italy reversed course in 2014 and elected a fresh-faced reformer, Matteo Renzi, 41, of the center-left Democratic Party, as prime minister. But just 2 years later, Renzi now embodies the old guard he set out to destroy. In local elections this week, the Five Star Movement, an anti-corruption party led by former comedian Beppe Grillo, trounced the Democrats. The party's Virginia Raggi, a 37-year-old lawyer, won 67% of the vote to become Rome's first female mayor in the city's 3,000-year history. Voters apparently saw her utter lack of political experience as a big positive. This revolt is led by the poor, those who feel alienated from government and angry at the political class. Their loathing of professional politicians is so deeply rooted that it has caused them to turn their backs on Renzi before he's even been in office long enough to help them. It's like a mutiny. The crew has handed over command of the ship not to the second in command, but to the cabin boy, who can't be suspected of having ever colluded with the captain. But will the ship sail? Rome will soon find out. This from France, striking for perks of a bygone era. When will the French grow up? Asks Denu Flamand. A major French labor union is having yet another nationwide temper tantrum, blocking roads and trade and staging protests. Even the Eiffel Tower has had to temporarily close down because staff walked out. It's almost impressive that the French won't allow threats of terrorism or the fact that they are hosting an international soccer championship, Euro 2016, to deter them from their true national pastime, striking. But this time, it would be in their own interest to put down the placards and return to work. At issue is a new law before the Senate that would make it easier for companies to hire and fire workers and let them require employees to work more than 35 hours a week. Practically every other European Union country already has these laws on the books. Only the French are unwilling to accept them. Unfortunately for them, their country is part of a globalized world. If another comparable labor markets are more flexible than France's, and they are, then investment and jobs will flow to them, and the French will see their economy crumble. What good is it to insist that you won't work more than 35 hours when you don't have a job at all? This column from Brazil. Guess who won't get paid? The Olympics have been one long swindle for Brazil, said Michael Royster. The state of Rio de Janeiro, host of this summer's games, last week declared a financial calamity, effectively admitting it was bankrupt. For more than a year, Rio has been unable to pay public workers, including school teachers. It has failed to give pensioners their stipend they depend on. But never fear, now that the governor has invoked special circumstances, money will suddenly materialize. Not for the elderly or the teachers, of course, only to pay the contractors working on Olympic projects. State and municipal governments can now throw out the rule book for public contracts and pay the corrupt contractors all the extras they claim for work not done on time. Much of that work will never be completed because contractors have already siphoned off too many millions of dollars into the offshore bank accounts of corrupt politicians. That's just how it works in Brazil. Shady companies gave money to political campaigns, and in turn the bought-off legislators approved their benefactors' ridiculously low sham bids for Olympic projects. It was always obvious that, come crunch time, the Pauls would raid public coffers to pay the contractors and stiff the people. And this is a How They See Us column. Fury over U.S. bases in Japan. Okinawans have had enough of American soldiers abusing and killing us, said the Ryukyu Shimpo in an editorial. After a civilian contractor stationed at the U.S. Kadena Air Base in Okinawa was arrested for alleged rape and murder of a 20-year-old local woman, tens of thousands of island residents protested this week against the American military presence. The victims' fathers gave an impassioned speech, asking all Okinawans to come together as one in demanding the withdrawal of all bases to prevent any more of our sons and daughters from becoming victims. We all remember the woman raped by two Navy officers in 2012, the multiple victims of car accidents involving U.S. personnel, and worst of all, the 1995 rape of a 12-year-old girl by three American servicemen. After each crime, the U.S. military promises stricter discipline, but the rap sheet continues. Just last month, a U.S. sailor drove drunk and crashed into two cars, hospitalizing two Okinawans. At this point, the anger and sadness of Okinawans toward the continuous crimes and accidents involving people affiliated with the U.S. military has passed the tipping point. The anger is directed as much at Tokyo as it is at Washington, said Turo Hiane in Mainichi Shimbun. Memories of rage and agony are now gushing out. How many times have Okinawans held mass rallies to mourn rape or murder victims of U.S. soldiers? Yet their angry voices have instantly been forgotten by those on the mainland. For years, the U.S. and Japanese governments have been discussing the relocation of at least one base from a populated area to a more remote part of the island, where most Okinawans would be safe from the Americans. At this point, though, the island may well demand the removal of all 30,000 U.S. military personnel and contractors from their prefecture. This growing anti-base sentiment is shaping up to be a major power struggle between Okinawa and Tokyo, said the Nikkei Asian Review. Okinawa was occupied by the U.S. after World War II until 1972, and locals feel they are still enduring occupation. After all, Okinawa makes up less than 1% of Japan's landmass, but hosts about half of the American soldiers and sailors stationed in the country. No wonder that in local elections this month, voters gave an expanded legislative majority to supporters of Okinawa's Governor Takeshi Onaga, who opposes the construction of a new Marine Corps airfield on the north of the island and wants the U.S. military presence reduced. The U.S. may have to yield, said the Asahi Shimbun, though Japanese authorities have pointed out to Okinawans that the crime rate among U.S. personnel is lower than among the island's civilian population, such appeals to logic are in vain. The issue is no longer about crime statistics. It's about national identity. Both the Japanese and U.S. governments should take the voice of Okinawan protests seriously and seize this opportunity to reconsider their rigid stance. Read one of the obituaries this week. The author who thrilled young adult readers, Lois Duncan, 1934 to 2016. In 1997, Lois Duncan went to watch the movie adaptation of her classic young adult thriller, I Know What You Did Last Summer. The best-selling author expected the film to stay faithful to her 1973 novel, a largely gore-free tale about four teenagers who try to conceal an accidental killing. But to her dismay, Duncan discovered that the filmmakers had turned her story into a bloody horror flick, with the characters gruesomely murdered by the hook-wielding fishermen they thought they'd killed. The first time I knew it was a slasher movie was when I bought my popcorn and bought my ticket and excitedly walked into the theater, Duncan recalled. The heads were dropping and the blood was spurting and I was screaming. Born in Philadelphia, Duncan grew up in Sarasota, Florida, and sold her first story to a magazine when she was 13, said the New York Times. She enrolled at Duke University but dropped out to marry a classmate and began writing young romance novels, then a virtually unknown genre. When her marriage ended in the early 1960s, Duncan moved to Albuquerque, taught journalism at the University of New Mexico, and wrote for magazines, including Good Housekeeping. She remarried in 1965 and returned to young adult writing, pivoting from romance to suspense, said the Washington Post. Her first noted thriller was Ransom, 1966, in which five teenagers are taken hostage by their school bus driver. Over the next 23 years, Duncan pumped out thrillers including Stranger with My Face, Down a Dark Hall, and Killing Mr. Griffin, helping establish the genre of young adult fiction. Then in 1989, Duncan's 18-year-old daughter, Caitlin, was shot dead while driving home. It was as if these things I'd written about became hideous reality, Duncan said. Police concluded that the murder, for which no one was convicted, was likely a random drive-by shooting. But the author never stopped searching for a motive and the perpetrator, said the Los Angeles Times. She documented her hunt in the award-winning Who Killed My Daughter, 1992, concluding that Caitlin may have been targeted because she'd found out about an insurance fraud scheme. For the rest of her career, Duncan largely shifted her focus from thrillers to picture books. "I went weak after Kate's murder," she explained. "How could I even think about creating a novel with a young woman in a life-threatening situation?" On the Talking Points page, Trump, the growing Republican revolt. For roughly 7 days in May, Donald Trump was on the upswing, said Jamel Bowie in Slate.com. He had locked up the Republican nomination, secured the support of GOP House Speaker Paul Ryan, and was building momentum against Democratic rival Hillary Clinton. If you squinted, he looked like a candidate who could win. Weeks later, Trump's campaign is in free fall and Republicans are panicking amid growing fears his unhinged rhetoric and amateurish campaign will drag the party down to a historic defeat in November. Trump's repeated racist attacks on an American-born federal judge he called a Mexican and his crude, exploitative response to the Orlando massacre have caused his unfavorable ratings to spike to an unprecedented and catastrophic high of 70%. He hasn't broken 40% in total support for nearly 2 weeks and now trails Clinton by 5.8 points in the Real Clear Politics average and 12 points in the latest Bloomberg survey. His campaign is virtually broke and in complete disarray. A year ago, Republicans believed they could begin 2017 with control of the White House, Senate, and House, said Ramesh Ponnanuru in Bloomberg.com. But if Trump loses in a landslide, the GOP faces a very real prospect of being shut out of national power altogether. Republicans are not just panicking. They're in a state of revolt, said Michael Gerson in WashingtonPost.com. Nearly 400 delegates have signed on to an effort to stop Trump's nomination at the Republican convention in July and are lobbying for a rule change that would free the convention's 2,472 delegates to vote for whomever they like. That effort got a big boost last week when House Speaker and Convention Chairman Paul Ryan, clearly chagrined at Trump's recent behavior, said delegates should follow their conscience. One party insider said that if Trump is nominated at the convention, it would feel like a funeral for a relative everyone hates. At this stage, said John Podhertz in CommentaryMagazine.com, stopping Trump may be the only way for Republicans to avoid a near-extinction event. In the 7 weeks since becoming the presumptive nominee, Trump has proved himself temperamentally unfit for the presidency, attacking Muslim and Mexican Americans, implying that President Obama might be a secret jihadist, and banning multiple news organizations from his campaign events. Given this deranged behavior, denying Trump a victory on the first ballot and throwing the convention open might not only be the wise thing to do, it would be the moral thing to do. Republican panic might be premature, said Chuck Todd in NBCNews.com. Despite trailing badly in national polls, Trump is still alive in the battleground states. Clinton is only 1 point ahead in Pennsylvania, according to the latest Quinnipiac poll, while in Ohio the race is tied at 40% each. And let's not forget that Clinton has her own serious popularity problem to deal with, said Josh Voorhees in Slate.com. Clinton's unfavorability rating has hit its own new high of 55%, and we're still a long way from November. If Trump finally listens to his advisors and stops alienating large swaths of the country, he could claw his way back into this race. 70-year-olds do not change, said Matthew Continetti in FreeBeacon.com. My fellow Republicans should be under no illusions. This is not a good man. This is not a stable man. Trump is the least qualified, least knowledgeable presidential nominee in recent history, a petty narcissist who knows nothing and has done nothing but promote himself for 30 years. His joke of a campaign will drive the Republican Party into the ground. And what's most disturbing of all is that Donald Trump is what a very large number of Republican voters want. A radical, childish big mouth who vents their anger and allows them to wallow in self-righteousness, in helplessness, in self-serving self-pity. But what worked in the primaries is failing miserably in the general election, said Jennifer Rubin in the WashingtonPost.com. A new CNN poll found this week that 48% of Republican voters want someone else as the party's nominee. Fewer and fewer Republican donors, elected officials, and operatives think Trump can win. Why are we just waking up to this reality now? During the primaries, a plurality of GOP voters applauded his lunacy, bigotry, and ignorance, and shrugged off his rotten character and his pants-on-fire lies. Clearly, conservative leaders have to do more leading, stop pandering to bigots, and fighting for lost causes, and expand the Republican vision to include all Americans, not just angry white guys. At this point, the GOP needs not only a new candidate, but also a new base. Muslim Americans, are they assimilating? Does the U.S. have an assimilation problem with Muslims? Asked Noah Rothman in CommentaryMagazine.com. After the massacre in Orlando, Donald Trump claimed that Muslim Americans, including those who were born in the U.S., have failed to integrate into American society. But the presumptive Republican nominee is sorely mistaken. Recent Pew Research Center studies have concluded that, unlike in Western Europe, where Muslim immigrants sequester themselves into gritty ghettos, America's 3.3 million Muslims are well integrated into our society. Most describe themselves as middle class and live in well-off communities, and 70% say they believe in the American dream of getting ahead through hard work. They're as likely as other Americans to graduate college and have a household income of $100,000 or more. And they're roughly as religious as U.S. Christians. Sadly, America has no magic formula for assimilating Muslims, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. As the terrorist attacks in Orlando and San Bernardino attest, ISIS is finding takers for its murderous ideology here. True, we don't have the same level of alienation and radicalization as France does, but that's probably because only 1% of the U.S. population is Muslim, compared with 7.5% in France. But one of the few enclaves of poor Muslim immigrants in the U.S. is the Somali community in Minneapolis, and it's been a rich recruiting ground for Islamist extremists. Consider this alarming statistics, also found by Pew, said Byron York in Washington Examiner. While 81% of Muslim Americans say Islamist violence was always wrong, 13% thought it could be justified in certain cases. That's just under 400,000 people. Most Americans see assimilation as an unambiguous good, said Rehan Salam in Slate.com. But many second-generation Muslim Americans see it as a mixed blessing at best. To fully assimilate into a new society, they have to surrender cherished aspects of their native culture and loosen ties to family and friends back home. Sometimes immigrants want to apply the brakes, and that can take the form of embracing the more authentic brand of Islam they find online, which fuses religion with deep political anger at indignities suffered by Muslims worldwide. Yet it's also true that when Trump sharpens the dividing line by declaring that Muslims aren't assimilating at all, he also certainly makes matters worse. And a few shorter notes as we wind out the hour. Last month was the hottest May in recorded history, the 13th straight month of record-breaking heat, federal scientists say. May's global average of 60.17 degrees Fahrenheit was 1.57 degrees above the 20th century average. Lawmakers have introduced more than 100 gun control proposals in Congress over the past 5 years, all of which have failed. Most didn't make it to the House or Senate floor for a vote. People on the terrorism watch list applied to buy firearms 244 times in 2015. After a background check, 91% of them were approved. And we'll finish with a quote from Gabriel Garcia Marquez. It is not true that people stop pursuing dreams because they grow old. They grow old because they stop pursuing dreams. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.